Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, A Death in the Dry River by Lisa Allen Agostini, and my most recent book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. You can also support the show by buying us a cup of coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. Rick DeAmbert is a freelance writer, musician, artist, and lecturer. He has been following a pagan path since the early 1990s. Rick writes on arts and culture for various websites in Central Florida. His book, Crows and Ravens, Mystery, Myth, and Magic of Sacred Corvids, was published by Llewellyn in March 2024. Previously, Rick was the arts and entertainment writer at the Daytona Beach News Journal, a daily newspaper, for 23 years. And he also served a three-year stint as the rock and hip-hop music writer at the Tennessean in Nashville. He's interviewed such creators as Kurt Vonnegut, Yoko Ono, Ray Manzarek of The Doors, Janet Jackson, Shirley MacLaine, and many others. Rick DeAmbert, welcome to Witchlit.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I'm it's always a good day to talk about crows and witches and literature and all that stuff. So it's a good day.
And we're putting you on the other side of the interview today, it sounds like.
Oh, I have some tales about that. When I worked at the Daytona paper in the mid-90s, spring break was happening, and reporters from across the U.S. would call, just say, oh, what's going on spring break? I thought they were just looking for background, but several times I realized, oh, this reporter's interviewing me about the spring break scene, and then funny talk backwards, me talks, not put sentence coherent together me, because it was so strange being on the other side of the interview dynamic. Yeah. So yeah. I've gotten better at that, I hope. So,
okay. So our first question for everybody on the show, especially in this age of just like media explosion in many ways, although not all written, I mean, a lot, obviously social media and video and things like that. And maybe this is even a different kind of question for you, having come from journalism, is why still write? Why still write books in this media era?
On a practical side, in writing my Crows and Ravens book, there's a wonderful website called archive.org that has a lot of century-old journals, and among many other holdings that have been digitized. And so I found a lot of Celtic history and Norse mythology history journals online that were written back in the late 1880s. Anyway, archive.org sends out a newsletter. And a few months back, they sent one that said, oh, have you thought about this, people, that actual print books may outlive the digital versions of print? You know, and then they talked about how, you know, I can't play my 8-track tapes anymore because that's archaic. Do you even know what an 8-track tape is?
I remember. Yeah, okay. The first car I ever had an 8-track player in it.
There you okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. So on that practical sense, and I'm a book junkie. My home library, I don't have all my books out. Anyway, why write books? It's still... I think the books are going to last longer, can last longer than this technology. I have like 10 flash drives that don't work because they just crapped out, and I always back my stuff up.
Yeah.
So that's the practical side. I think books are like extended conversations. Mm-hmm. I read a lot of essays. I read a lot of opinion columns. I'm a New York Times junkie. I want to know what other people think, but in books, I use my home library like an actual library. Mm-hmm. If you say, you know, you said East Tennessee, Chattanooga, where and Knoxville. So I'm probably going to have some books on, well, I know I have lots of books on Southern history. So if I'm intrigued enough, I can go to my library and find something on Southern history beyond Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. So that's how I use, people look at my books and they say, oh, have you read all these books? And the answer is no. I mean, I've probably got, I don't know, 10,000 or whatever. But I have read in 98% of those books because they're almost all nonfiction. I'll pick up, whether it's my pagan library, my world history, my world religions. If you mention the word, if you mention Kali, the Hindu warrior goddess, instead of going online, I'm going to go to a book and read about her. Mm-hmm. Because, and authors have probably done more research, book writers, I would think. Mm-hmm. And now with this whole AI thing, you know, it's, is content, is that AI generated? I haven't decided what I think about AI, but I trust books that people have researched. And if not, I'll throw, you know, if the book appears to be poorly researched, then I just won't buy it. So I don't know. I'm ambling. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, I think so. I think the permanence of books, of like physical books, is a thing. And I was thinking, you mentioned Wikipedia, and there's a pretty prominent tech journalist I follow who has a podcast now and was basically saying, you know, Wikipedia is the last bastion against AI because it's still edited by humans.
Yeah.
And, you know, that as the internet degrades, as information wise, we have this thing that initially people kind of poo-pooed, I guess, Wikipedia. Yeah. And now it's like, no, this is, you're going to get something real that's cited if you go look there or something.
And I didn't mean to disparage Wikipedia.
Oh, no. I mean, it just early days. I mean, I was teaching English when Wikipedia kind of debuted and we were like, you can't use Wikipedia as a reference. And now people are like, oh, that's where you go first to find what they've referenced to go research something.
Bingo. Yeah. And I guess another aspect of this, why books? In my journalism career, I love journalism. I covered hard news earlier in my career. Then I was arts and culture and entertainment and music writing. And, you know, anybody I would interview, I would say, look, this is going to be a snapshot of what we talk about. It's frustrating because in journalism, you may have at the most what we call 24 column inches. Mm-hmm. And that's not very much room to tell somebody's story or even a part of their story.
Yeah.
So it was always a little bit frustrating to have to work within that concise, confined space. So, and again, books, you know, the book length format, you know, my Crow library, again, while I found great stuff on archive.org and Wikipedia and New York Times and all that, I just love the deep dives that long form nonfiction writing provides. Yes. So there's always another journalism aphorism I always tell people when I asked to speak at college journalism classes. It's there's always a story behind the story, meaning there's a lot that doesn't get told.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, I think about that even in terms of a podcast, like we have about an hour together. Like there's only so much you can cover in that time.
Yeah. One other thing, which is actually in my Crow book, I think writing is a magical act. Mm-hmm. The process. And I, one of the exercises or not exercise or practical matters that I think any Wiccan or pagan or I can't speak for other religious paths is we should be keeping a magical journal. Now, that doesn't mean you have to write 10 pages a day, but you will forget stuff. And I'm a very big on, you know, if like with crows, I will write down if I see something unusual or goofy. And then 3 months later, it's like, oh, okay, I remember writing about something about the crow making this kitty cat sound. And so just writing, and if you write it down, you're able to see synchronicities, you're able to see mm-hmm. patterns, even if it's just short memory aids. I keep track of how many crows I see each day. Yeah. So believe it or not, I write it on my calendar. So mm-hmm. there's a lot of other reasons why I think writing is the example I use in my book. Back in the 80s, I was reading about sensory deprivation. What was that movie? Altered States.
Yeah.
John Lilly and his isolation tanks. There seem to be weird mind-bending things happen if you're able to shut down all sensory input. So I cleaned out my closet at my duplex, put towels down. I wanted there to be no sound, no light, nothing. And I just wanted to go in there and get as isolated as I could be. And who showed up in my weird psyche, whatever, for whatever reason? Jim Morrison of The Doors still was what came. It's like, what the freak? And he was kind of on fire. And I noted that, and I can't remember if I wrote it down, but now that's all I remember. Mm-hmm. I wish I had written in more detail about that trance experience. Mm-hmm. And especially, you know, a lot of people keep dream journals and stuff. I need to be better about doing that. So
I keep one by the bed. Do I always remember to write in it? No.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, that's a good step. So writing in various ways to me is very magical, and it's an mm-hmm. Aid to our spiritual practice. Mm-hmm. So yeah, end of sermon.
Oh, no. I think it's interesting. I mean, for me, I spent a lot of time trying to keep the things separated. Like writing was one bucket and magic and witchcraft or another bucket. And then finally, like sometime in my 40s, I was like, why are they separate in your brain?
Yeah.
So, yeah. We learn, we continue to learn as we get older, thankfully.
Yeah. Yes. Hopefully.
Yeah,
for sure.
So I'm curious, with your background, you know, kind of like you said, in hard news and then arts and culture news, why a book on crows and ravens? So why this book?
Well, I became interested in crows. My heritage is Irish and French. D'Ampert is a French name, but on mm-hmm. my mom's side, my heritage is Irish. So I went to Ireland for the first time in 1995. And in Dublin is at the General Post Office is a statue of a bronze statue, kind of 12 or 15 feet tall, kind of over life size, of mm-hmm. Cuchulainn, the folk mythological folk warrior hero of ancient Irish mythology. And it's from the Irish mythological tales, and it depicts him dying, and he's tied himself to a post when he knew he was going to be dying at the end of a battle, so he would die upright. But on his shoulder was a crow carved in this statue, and that's mm-hmm. part of the myth too. Some mm-hmm. of the ancient Irish myths say it's the Morrigan, the Irish battle goddess who could shapeshift into a crow. That's probably the most common interpretation. Anyway, I didn't know a lot about my Irish roots then. Mm-hmm. And even when I went to Ireland, I'm a big fan of Yeats, the poet, and U2. And just the land looks so beautiful. And it's like, oh, okay, I'm part Irish. But it wasn't until I got back that I realized it was a roots. I did feel a deep connection to the land. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, that bird on the shoulder of Cuchulainn just intrigued me. And I started doing deeper dives into Celtic Irish mythology and found out their fixation on a lot of the tales with crows. The battle goddesses, various ones, could shapeshift into crows mm-hmm. and ravens. I was so intrigued. I mentioned this in the book. There's a book on Irish mythology, and I cite the writer in the book, but he writes about the last time one of the battle goddesses was seen in a battle in Ireland, and it was like from the year 1100 or something. And I love this historian because he's a credentialed academic, but he writes this, and that's that passage, at least to me, it appears that he takes it as a given that those warriors actually saw the Irish, the Morrigan battle goddess in the form of a crow harassing all these warriors on both sides. So he said, this was the last time the Morrigan was seen in Ireland. And I just love that he seemingly takes it at face value. So anyway, that's what started my fast. And then back home in Palm Coast, Florida, where I live, crows would come to my backyard daily. So I started seeing them in a different light, started feeding them, and soon noticed it's like, yeah, they always seem to be thinking. But that was it. And it was actually my editor, Heather Green. I wrote for a while for The Wild Hunt, online pagan news site. And I started posting. I would take photos of crows and shapeshift them. I didn't use AI, didn't exist, and I don't use Photoshop, but I use other programs because I wanted to make crows appear as magical and supernatural. So I would take photos, put this digital woo-woo on them, and have them printed on canvas. And I started posting those on Facebook. And people are like, oh, that's, oh, you know, because they look phantasmagoric and weird and all that kind of psychedelic, all that. Anyway, Heather saw that one of my postings, and she said, Rick, you should do a book on crows for Llewellyn. She had moved to Llewellyn by then. So she sent me a proposal outline. I filled it out. The book was approved. And suddenly I'm writing about crows. So,
it's funny how many Llewellyn authors I've had on the show who've had that kind of experience with the Heather or with one of the other editors at Llewellyn. Yeah. That, by the way, do you want to write this book?
You know, and I had never even thought about that in my freelance career. I left the Daytona newspaper in 2015 to pursue freelance writing. And music. I play sitar and native flutes. So I do freelance music gigs too. But a book length, you know, that was just kind of mind numbing at first. It's like, whoa. But I just from watching the crows in my backyard, and that's the thing, which one of the themes or motifs of the book is, for me, and I think for a lot of people, if they just stop to think about it, crows and ravens are a very near connection that anybody can have that is evidence of, for me as a pagan, of the mysteries and the existence of Gaia, the earth goddess. I write in the book, you know, dolphins are highly intelligent. I'm 2 miles from the ocean, but I only see dolphins out in the ocean or intercoastal fleetingly. I've never seen a gorilla or chimpanzee except in a zoo. But for most people in North America and even in Europe and around the world, crows and ravens are on all continents except Antarctica. They are the animal or creature or entity that people will have proximity to, and that where you can see, if you start even just kind of just casual observance, you will see that there's something going on with these birds. They're highly intelligent. They've got all these abilities and supernatural kind of abilities. So they are graphic present evidence that the world is more mysterious and wonderful than I think most people realize.
Yeah. I've always been a crow and raven fan. I think I've told this story somewhere recently, but when I was younger, my parents lived out on Watts Bar Lake in East Tennessee, which is, you know, fairly rural, but more, I guess, rural suburban. I don't know what you call it. But I was living with them when my son was little and I was driving home from work. I worked at a restaurant and I was coming home really late. And it was like at that, you know, a little past the gloaming, like not quite dark, but, you know.
Yeah.
And I was driving down this little country road and in the road is a rabbit, a squirrel and a crow facing each other. Like they're talking, like they're having a conversation. And my headlights hit them and all their little eyes turned to me and kind of shimmied. And then they parted, like they each went their own separate way. And I was like, I interrupted something important. It was so clear that there was something going down at the lake, you know, like, and I think about that when we, you know, here in California, we lived first when we first moved here in Sunnyvale for a couple of weeks in temporary housing. And Sunnyvale is kind of home to crows in the Bay Area. Like it's just the downtown is awash with crows, much to their unhappiness, I should say, because they have a lot of open air seating. Yeah. But the crows are abundant here and we have crows who come to our backyard. We give them peanuts. And so it's I've always felt a kinship with them, I guess. So,
you're a friend of crows. Good. Yeah. Good. Yeah.
I haven't seen them this morning, but we're also out of peanuts, so they may be mad at us.
Uh-oh. So. Yeah, they come by. It seems like every spring that there's different crows that start coming by, and people will say, oh, how can you tell the difference? They all look alike. Well, and I cover this in the book, but their behaviors are different.
Mm-hmm. They have personalities. They all have personalities.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And if you watch them, if you're blessed to have frequent crow visitors or that show up, and if you start noticing them, you'll see different behaviors, different walks. For 1 year, the three crows who would come by every day, they would disappear over my house with the crackers or tortilla chips I put out. It's like, where are they going? And then one day I was walking out. It's like they were going to my roof. And they were eating up there.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, at the next year, the new crows that came in, they don't do that. So, and I'm not sure why they seem to have this seasonal cycle. I think it might have to do with mating and raising.
Nesting and all that. Yeah.
Yeah. Nesting. So.
Yeah. It's funny. You bring this up in the book and I thought about it. I was reading, because I, you know, having been enamored of crows, I too know people who find them unnerving.
Yes.
And ravens especially find them unnerving. Yes. And when we first moved to Knoxville, when I moved back to Knoxville, the last time I lived there, a friend of mine had come over to visit. He's also a friend of crows. And we were sitting and we just heard this like murmur outside, like just, and I opened the curtain. And there are hundreds of crows.
I am so jelly.
Covered with crows. The power lines are covered with crows. The trees are full of crows. And they have just landed on our house. They were just blessed by crows. And I was telling someone the story and they were like, I would have never gone back. I would have sold my house and left. Oh, and I was like, what? You know, like to me, I really felt like the crows had welcomed us and they were like, they were completely weirded out that this had happened. My friend was with me and she was like, no, this is great.
Yeah, I am so jelly. I moved. I've been in Palm Coast since 2005, but 5 years ago, I literally moved 3 miles down the road. But in both places, my home backs up to woods. And in my previous place, the most crows I've ever seen at one time around my home was about 20 crows. Mm-hmm. And in my new place, the most I've seen around here are 9 or 10. Mm-hmm. So I am so jealous that you had this massive crow.
Yeah, it was really, I mean, it was slightly eerie in that they're just these, you know, inky presences in the sky.
Yes.
But, you know, it was also just so beautiful. And I think, you know, that's probably the most I've ever seen other than like the second is like downtown Sunnyvale. Like if you go down in the evening, sometimes you'll see a lot of crows. But here, like at our house, we get a couple. The thing that I find interesting here, and you live close to the ocean too, so this might be true for you, is that they flock with the seagulls. Like in the parking lots and stuff.
Wow. Wow.
And the parking lots and like the shopping centers around where we live, you'll drive it and there'll just be like a sea of crows and seagulls in the parking lot. It is the weirdest thing.
Wow. I the first time I saw crows on the beach here, and I'm just north of Daytona Beach. So your listeners, that may be a better reference of exactly. I'm on the East Central Florida coast. Mm-hmm. First time I saw crows on the beach, which was, I don't know, a decade or so ago. I'm like, what? What's going on? Yeah. I just, at that time, I had no idea about how diverse their habitat is. And then they're, of course, they're very, you know, you mentioned downtown, what, Sunnyvale or Knox, anywhere, but they're very crows more than ravens. Mm-hmm. Ravens seem to be a bit more people shy. I call, in the book, I call crows human gregarious because they're comfortable around people, but they will keep their, they're watching us as much as we watch them.
They like to mess with their cats in the windows. The cats really? Will watch them and they like to dive bomb the cats and tease them.
Oh, see, yeah, so. They have such a sense of play. And almost every writer I've read who's written a book on crows, and I think I say this in my book, crows look like they're always thinking. Mm-hmm. They're always watching. Yeah. And I think that's true. They're intelligent and they, in fact, I was just reading, a friend sent me a story today. A new research has supposedly proven that crows can count, that they will audibly count if for whatever the occasion may be, up to four. And they will vocalize this counting. So,
I mean, the thing I wonder too is like, as they spend more time in this like interface with humans, they learn more about us too. So, and what do they pick up from us? I mean, I know that there are some crows that can kind of mimic human sound. But I'm just curious, like, what are they learning about us? As we learn about them.
I have friends of friends, and I've had people email me that, my uncle had a crow that would land on his shoulder and walk around the farm. And people send me these YouTube videos of crows who have befriended this little boy and all this and that.
Bring gifts.
In my experience, even now, like I said, it seems like new crows come in every spring season. But I go out to throw crackers or popcorn on the lawn, and inevitably they will hop up or fly up two or three branches higher. Mm-hmm. And so they're as comfortable as they seem to be with me. They keep coming back, but which is
they
something
keep their distance a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. And my editor, Heather Green, she lives in Atlanta. And she emailed me, or maybe we were talking by phone. I think it was email. She said, I hear crows around my home all the time, but I can't get them to come to my yard. Mm-hmm. And I said, it probably might be a case of something happened to a crow in your backyard without you knowing it.
Yeah.
And they're intelligent enough to mark a place as a danger to crows. Mm-hmm. And they're able to communicate that, not just to if a crow saw another crow killed
Or hit
not
the house,
only that crow will know. Yeah, they will tell the other crows. And so the whole crow tribe around an area will say, don't go here or don't shun this person because danger. Mm-hmm. So it could be something like that. So. And I'm still learning stuff about crows. It's it's crazy. I don't know that there will be a sequel, but there could be.
I'm sure. Yeah, there's more to be written about them. So I'm curious, like, kind of on that thread, I guess, for the research for this book, obviously, there's a lot. I mean, if people pick up the book, the bibliography section is quite large. So in your reading, like, what... did you come across something that just really surprised you about crows or about ravens and kind of how they interact with us or the world?
Oh, just constantly. It seems like everybody knows now because it's in my book, John Marsliff, this University of Washington wildlife biologist, he's the one who did experiments proving that crows recognize and remember mm-hmm. human faces. And now when I first read that and was reading about the details of his experiment, I'm just like, you know, mind blown.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to think, I started the book like in 2018. There were a number of things that kept delaying it, But now when I mention that, people just shake their heads. Oh yeah, I know. So the people seem to have know about that. Yeah. But when I first found that out, that was just, mind blowing that, I gather from what I've read, there's a few other animals that may have that ability. I mm-hmm. think maybe elephants, if I read correctly, and octopus, they seem to have high intelligence. So that was one thing. And mm-hmm. then just reading the ancient myths. My pagan path is Celtic, Irish, but not solidly. I'm kind of eclectic. Mm-hmm. But when I was reading about the Norse myths, so I knew something about Odin and the Norse pantheon. Mm-hmm. But when I read that Odin has these two ravens on his shoulder, Hugin and Munin, which their names are traditionally translated as thought and memory. Like, oh, that's interesting. And then after watching the crows around my home for a while and reading the Norse myths, of course, the ancient Norse, the ancient Scandinavians named those two birds thought and memory because they were watching these birds and they realized they seem to have thought. They don't just act on instinct.
Mm-hmm.
And they must have seen, like we modern humans, that they have memory. That if we did something to a crow, then the crow shuns that person or that neighborhood. So it was kind of a natural biological thing that those crows, that those ravens came to be named thought and memory. But yet it's also got that mystical, magical element because these creatures, the ancients realized, these are not just little biological instinct machines here. There's more going on.
I think that's one of the things that's interesting about the way you kind of put the book together. For folks who haven't read it yet, there's chapters kind of like on the science of crows, like what we know about crows and ravens. And then there's chapters like grimoire chapters and lore chapters. And they kind of build as the book goes on each other. And I thought it was really an interesting way to weave it together because I think, not solely crows and ravens, but I think a lot of animals that have, or that humans have this kind of connection with, like you mentioned dolphins and great apes and, those kind of things. Like, I think we have built so much of our own lore and practice on the behaviors of these birds, right? Or the behaviors of these animals. And I just thought it was interesting to look at the way you kind of laid it out in the book, all of the different cultures that, not all of them, hence the reason there could be a second book, but how many cultures have this deep lore about these particular birds specifically. I thought it was a really interesting way to lay the book out.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier about things that surprised me when I came across some translations of some ancient Hebrew text, and I was just blown away that this is in the book, but there's a raven was on Noah's ark and Noah accuses the raven of, Noah's says, okay, raven, you've got to go out and see if we can find land. And the raven accuses Noah, saying, oh, you just want to get rid of me because you want to hook up with my wife. And I just thought, raven, one, he could talk. Mm-hmm. And Noah is having this conversation with raven. And then raven accuses, I had to read that passage like 10 times. Am I reading this correctly?
I was
not
familiar with that story and was greatly amused by it because ravens to me, though crows definitely have that trickster personality, ravens
They've got their own agenda. Yeah, exactly. And I'm here in Florida. There, Audubon and other guidebooks, nature guides, say there mm-hmm. are no ravens in Florida. Mm-hmm. They don't. So there's ravens in the Northeast and out West. And I'm mm-hmm. sure you probably have seen ravens.
I haven't seen ravens in the wild here yet. I'm waiting. The only time I have been in the presence of a raven that wasn't like at a zoo, and it's tentatively is at the Ravens at the Tower in London.
Okay.
And the guide, the beefeater guide that we had for our tour was like, don't mess with them because they do bite and they like human flesh.
Whoa.
It's like, okay.
Whoa. You know, I can't remember if I put this, I think I did put this in the book, but I read somewhere and it seemed to be a credible source. You know, you probably are aware that there's this legend that as long as the ravens are mm-hmm. living in the Tower of London, that England or Britain will not fall yeah. to an invader. And no. then I read somewhere, I don't know, years back, that they clipped the raven's wings.
They are clipped.
I know. And I just thought, man, we humans.
They still fly. I mean, they still fly up on things, but they've clipped their primary feathers so they can't do the... But we did see them do, like, you know, ravens do that thing on the thermals that crows don't really do.
Right. Yes.
And so one of them, when we were there, when we were in England, there was a hurricane in the North Atlantic. So it was so windy the whole time we were there. And so we got to see that a little bit, like the ravens kind of doing that at the tower.
Oh, but, I am so jelly.
The thing that I remember on that trip, though, was not ravens. It was, you know, because London is just littered with pigeons. They are everywhere in London.
Oh, yeah.
And we had gone to do like we got one of the city buses and just kind of rode around to look at Trafalgar and all that. And we went to the end of the line and we had to wait and then get back on the bus. And in the middle of that, this pigeon is flying at us and just paused in midair because it's so windy. Like it can't get headway in the wind.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, this is pretty weird. But yeah, I mean, luckily we got out before the hurricane actually hit the UK. But it did kind of change some of the things that happened while we were there, including the ravens at the tower. But it was an interesting trip. And, and still the ravens are the thing I remember almost most about that trip.
Yeah.
And some family in jokes. But
I cover in the book, what's the difference between crows and ravens? There's just mm-hmm. some basic differences. If you ever see them side by side, and I'm sure it sounds like you know this, Victoria, but ravens are considerably larger.
Oh, they're big.
They're considerably large, up to 20% larger than crows. Mm-hmm. Ravens have shaggy throat feathers. In flight, ravens' tail feathers look kind of more diamond shaped, where mm-hmm. crows are kind of more straight edged.
Like a fan, like almost like a fan. Yeah.
And what you just alluded to, from what I've read, that ravens are more acrobatic in flight, mm-hmm. that they will fly upside down and do barrel rolls and all mm-hmm. this crazy
now
stuff.
Now I really want to see it. Now I want to see, on a quest to see ravens now more.
Yeah, well, yeah, me too. I have friends who went out west, and I grew up in northern New Mexico, but back then, you know, I can't even... Anyway, I wasn't on my pagan path. Da, 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 da. But anyway, have friends who aren't pagan who come back from being out west, and they knew I was writing my book, and they said, "Rick, I know what you mean about ravens. I saw some blackbirds out there, and they were huge. And I that must have been ravens and not crows." So
It's funny you say blackbirds, and we were. A few weeks ago, we went to Yosemite just for the day to you know, we were like, let's just drive to Yosemite. It's only 3.5 hours. So we went to Yosemite for the day. And I thought they were grackles. We kept seeing these little blackbirds with like the iridescent wings like a grackle has, you know, and mm-hmm. the yellow eyes. And apparently they're brewer's blackbirds, which I was not familiar with. But my son and his wife are huge birders. So they knew exactly what they were when they saw them. And, but I was just like, it's funny to me, like how, though, yes, crows and ravens, it seems like all blackbirds have kind of a, we kind of have this special Like, they're just set apart from a lot of other birds. Like, with lore and mythology, we have this thing about blackbirds, you know?
Yeah, yeah, certainly. And on a tangent of all this, which I advise, and I think any of us pagans or witches, anybody who's following what we call an earth-based spirituality, it's almost a requirement to have some kind of nature guide, whether it's an Audubon guide, and not just for birds, but just for the nature, especially in your area.
Yeah, Peterson's is the one that we...
Oh, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And just to know who we're sharing this planet with.
Yeah, I still cling to all of my Eastern Tennessee plant and, I guess, flora and fauna books, but I'm slowly buying the California West.
Yeah, okay.
Western
yeah.
ones to do it, because it's funny, like you said, that when we first moved out here, like the plant life is so different in California from East Tennessee. I mean, we have a magnolia tree in our yard, which still cracks me up that they planted magnolias out here, because they don't let them flourish to their full beautiful magnolia thing. They trim them up so that they just have branches at the top. So they're all a little murdered out here, which is sad to me, because they plant them as street trees, which is very strange to me, because I would never plant like a alley of magnolias as a street tree. But
wow.
But there are lots of new things I've never seen before. And I was just like, okay, I need a book, because I don't know. And there's no way to, I mean, I like the apps and stuff, but sometimes those can be a little wonky, especially for plants. Yeah. So
yes. Yeah.
But I agree, guides, you know, it's important to read, I think, occult books and kind of, you know, that, but I think sometimes as you know, magical practitioners, whatever your bent, we forget that there's a lot of other stuff out there that can help us on our path. And I agree with you. One of those is nature guides.
Exactly. And I guess, I don't know. I knew when the idea, when Heather and Llewellyn said, yes, let's do this book. Mm-hmm. I knew that it had to have a chapter on the science of corvids. Mm-hmm. Just some of this. And I'm pretty sure I allude to this in the book. John Marsliff, and I highly recommend his books.
They're excellent. Yeah, I love his
books. He is the man. I would love to meet him someday and just say, thank you for writing your books on crows and ravens. But there was an article, I may have been in the New York Times magazine, but it shows a crow anesthetized and it's going into an MRI machine. It's going into an MRI machine because he literally was going to study the brain patterns of crow. I mean, that's how serious, you know, and he's a, you know, a scholar and academic and degreed and all that. And I just thought I think it's just so important. I mean, there's science does not have to diminish or kill off the magical and mystical to me. The deeper we get into that, the more they walk in harmony. Now, it doesn't mean I understand, but you know, my basic definition of magic is, you know, it's based on fifth grade science, where we learned that all matter is revolving molecules, protons, electrons, atoms, everything is constantly in motion. The universe is energy. Mm-hmm. This table that I'm here, it seems solid, but you know, modern physics says actually there's a lot of space and it's energy. Mm-hmm. And so when we start thinking about that, that's where it's like, and I know even some people will poo-poo the you can't use quantum physics to justify magic. Some of the hardcore rationalists will say that.
Yeah.
And I'm just like thinking that's bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's just bullshit, because the universe is more mysterious than we realize.
Yeah. I think so too. I have several friends who are scientists who are also magical people and Or like, I think it's just, we haven't figured out what it is yet, but that doesn't mean it's not real.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one of the motifs that runs through my book. I use the word communion a lot. I think crows and ravens offer that opportunity just to have this communion with nature, with Gaia, who I personify nature as Gaia, the earth goddess. That's part of my pagan path. Is there, and Gaia in her whimsy and wonder has put these magical birds right here in just about everybody's backyard. They're very urban. When I was writing the book, I was trying to think, wow, what if you're in an apartment in New York City or San Francisco, or you live in Midtown, Duluth, or wherever, how much are they going to be seeing crows and ravens? And I think quite a bit, because crows are very, especially crows, they're very much at home in urban environments. So it's a quote unquote easy way to seek and build communion with nature. And for me, I will never look at crows again the same. I mean, I see crows, I don't automatically think of the Morgan or Cuchulainn, but kind of, sort of, because, and I put this in the book. There's another thing. You asked me the first question. What did I find that was, shocking or unusual? Well, when I saw the painting, the cave painting from Lascaux in France, those ancient cave paintings, 18,000 to 20,000 years old, and there's a bird-headed figure painted on the walls, and John Marsliff and myself and others pretty much feel it's a crow-headed figure, and it seems to be very shamanic. So that tells me that far back, these birds were glamoring, to use the vampire term, they're glamoring humankind. Humans, our ancient ancestors took notice, like, whoa, what's going on here?
Yeah.
They are palpable evidence of this mystery of Gaia and earth energies and life and on this planet and beyond.
I think, how many ancient writings involve crows, like Aesop's fable with the crows, and there's just so many, and raven-headed deities in Egypt, and they've been with us for a long time.
Yes, absolutely. And you mentioned earlier about books. I found so much for me, all bookstores are sacred. So, and Amazon too. I know Amazon, big freaking corporate anyway, but I found a number of books that I was able to order online that have, birding books or ornithological books that were written in the 1920s or 30s and maybe were reprinted in the 50s. But a number of them, this is how kind of strange it got, because there's all this lore in each of these books are documented anthropology or what's the animal word, biology or anyway. It's like, I've never seen this in another book. How accurate is this? And it's just because there's so much information there. And different scientists and scholars focus on this or that.
Yeah.
So when I came across, these ancient Sumerian reproduction or drawings of these ancient Sumerian artifacts that has a two-headed raven on an axe, I'm like, whoa. And I wouldn't have discovered that if I hadn't come across this book. It may be online somewhere, but I found it in a book. So yay books.
Oh, well, I think that's a good place to kind of start to wrap things up. But before we get to our last question, our game of chance, I want to give you an opportunity to kind of tell folks where they can find you if you want to be found, and where to get your book and all of that good stuff.
Well, the book is on Amazon, and it is on the Llewellyn website. Like I said earlier, to me, all bookstores are sacred. So I don't want to rag on the big box chains, Barnes and Noble and Books a Million. Believe me, I've found plenty of books there.
Yeah.
But I'm also just a huge, frankly, in Daytona, I just kind of peeked in Books a Million and Barnes and Noble, and they don't have my book. It's, you know, their shelf space is limited. Their mm-hmm. metaphysical sections are not large. So I'm very big in supporting local metaphysical and mm-hmm. what I endearingly call witchy poo stores. So I don't know if you remember witchy poo.
Oh, yeah.
For me, that's not a derogatory term. That's a term of endearment. So those will have it. As far as what I've got going, you mentioned that this won't be out until late July. So I have some Crow workshops that I'm doing in the mm-hmm. Palm Coast area. But by the time this comes out, I'll be beyond that. Mm-hmm. So I would, if you're in the East Central Florida or Central Florida area, check out my Facebook and Instagram, Rick DeAmpert. And that's where I will certainly post any happenings. I'm going to be at the Summer Magic Festival in Orlando. That's coming up early June. My girlfriend, Michelle, we try to go to all the major pagan gatherings in Central Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so that's where
we
are.
See you there if they
okay,
are there.
Yes.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Great. So our last question is a little bit of a game of chance. I always joke that part of the reason I love Ravens and Crows is I'm Scorpio, and you know, we don't know how to do small talk, and I like to talk about things we're not supposed to talk about. So I'm going to roll this die, and depending on what number I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. Oh, or if I roll a six, you get to pick which one you want, and you can pass.
Okay, so. can I root for a sex or death question?
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
let's see what we get. Maybe the die will sex. Smile on us. Oh, so how about four? Or do you want to talk about, or do you want me to roll it again? Do you want to talk about politics?
Politics? Yeah, no, okay. I'm game. I don't know. Did you just the crows or did you hear the?
Mm-mm.
Can you hear? Did you hear the crow?
They
did
no.
not come through.
Oh, okay. And the mic didn't pick it up. Oh, bummer.
Okay.
That'd be great to have the podcast blessed with crows.
Yeah.
I had to close the window because our neighbors are working on a car behind us.
Oh,
but usually you can hear them with the window open. So your question, the politics. So I was just thinking about this, and I try to make the questions kind of related to what we've talked about before. So I try not to left field people too much. But so as someone who's obviously deeply connected to the land where you live and where you've lived, and interested in the, you know, well-being of the creatures we share the world with. So as a magical practitioner, what do you feel like the responsibility of magical people are to, you know, kind of shepherd us through this phase we're in with the climate crisis and all that? Like, what do you see our role in this?
Short answer is I see it as huge.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's just in various online groups and posts, I see that there are covens and pagan groups who are doing actual magical workings.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important and interesting. But I think on the local, I love that bumper sticker. It may even have been from the late 60s hippie era, but there used to be a bumper sticker. I haven't seen it in a while. Maybe I need to print them up and give them out. But this the saying, think globally, act locally.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was about 2 years ago. I was literally back on my back patio is my office. I'm out here on my back patio now, and a bobcat came into my yard because I'm back on woods, mm-hmm. and it just sat at the corner of my yard for about 15 minutes. I took photos. I wrote something up for the local news website that I write for, and you know, and a number of people said, and I think accurately, they said, oh, the reason it's in your yard is because we humans are crowding out their habitat.
Yeah.
And here in. Yes. Okay.
I did hear it that time.
Yeah. They're here. I'm going to come feed you in a second. I swear. They got to where they come by like 5 or 6 times a day. So anyway, back to the question. I think, can I influence climate change policy in Washington? Only with my single vote. But locally, there's probably more one can do. Mm-hmm. And I think being connected to the land wherever we pagans or Wiccans or witches or heathens or druids are is very important. And what can you do? Here locally, back in my early career, I covered planning commission meetings mm-hmm. at the newspaper in Dothan, Alabama. Not what I wanted to do with my career right. path, but
it seems
grateful
like where everybody starts. And
yeah, but I'm grateful for that education because that taught me that. That taught me that, no matter how much you think land is secure and preserved and protected, a government, local government regulation can open up this pristine 20 or 20,000 acres to development. Mm-hmm. And if you see a sign go up on an empty lot, it's probably because the developer's going to come in. So if you should become educated on how that yeah. process works. I think preserving the land, that's really big with me. And mm-hmm. okay, Rick, what have you done to do that? That's a tougher question. Yeah. That's a tougher question.
How as individuals do we move the needle is harder, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I think that I've written before, I think sometimes I think my pagan path or any pagan path, the key is awareness. I mm-hmm. like that word awareness. And in my book, I use the word communion a lot. Mm-hmm. I think just awareness of not just the nature that's under, right before our eyes, but just awareness of things, being awake. And we may not be able to stop something, a highway coming through a backyard, but at least if you're not aware of it, you're sure as heck not going to be able to,
right.
Influence matters. Yeah. So,
no, I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
And I think, I think one of the gifts of being kind of the occult space, like I said, whatever bent you have in it, is that, we do profess to have a connection with the natural world. Though I think sometimes in our Western mindset, we still see ourselves as separate from that. But it turns out the climate crisis is a really big sign about how we're not separate.
So. Yes. Yeah. And I'll tell on myself. I can't remember the book or the name. Or the writer's name, but I think the title was The World Without Us. Mm-hmm. And it was written, 6 or 8 years ago. I don't know if it was a scientist or a sociologist or just somebody. Mm-hmm. Anyway. Okay. Wow. They're getting uppity.
they're like, wrap it up. We want our crackers.
But anyway, this guy wrote about how the earth will be in 10,000 or 20,000, however long, when people have become extinct. Right. And he just imagines, he says, in New York City, and how it'll be like some sci-fi apocalypse movie where, nature has reclaimed. I just read in his book, I didn't read it from front to back. Mm-hmm. I'm telling on myself, but that comforted me because I feel that however much we humans are going to F up this wonderful, beautiful world, I am comforted that the world is going to outlive us. Yeah. And that as try as much as we, through neglect, if not willful, mm-hmm. Shit canning nature, I think the world, Gaia, is going to survive. The crows, they've been here for tens of thousands of years or whatever. And that's oddly comforting to me mm-hmm. that no matter how much we pave. Have you ever just walked anywhere in a city or anywhere where it's a kind of abandoned and the concrete will be cracked? And what comes up through the concrete? Weeds, you know, plants. It's like we smothered the earth and yet nature's going to win.
Nature will win.
That kind of comforts me. And my girlfriend, Michelle, she's really the apocalyptic one. She will readily embrace, you know, any thoughts of apocalypse. Me, I like the way the planet is now, but we're going to keep just using it for our own purposes. So anyway.
Wow. Awesome. Well, Rick, thank you. Thank you for this lovely book. And I hope people will pick it up and learn more about rams and crows in the magical sense. And good luck to you and your crows.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a joy, and many blessings to you. And what was it on Game of Thrones where, you know, they said, oh, I'll send a raven to send a message. So you send me a raven, I'll send you a raven, and we'll see.
Sounds good.
All right. Blessings to you, Victoria. Take care.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Witch Lit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witch Lit.